centre at 5. Kensington Council, which tried to hold a meeting about the Grenfell Tower fire behind closed doors, has been criticised by Downing Street. Matt Steele has more.
Why did you close the meeting down yesterday?
Nothing further to add.
Under fire, head of the council, Nicholas Paget-Brown, trying to avoid reporters.
Why are you so afraid to speak to him?
Last night, he shut down a council meeting after a court ruled the media must be allowed in. Caused an angry response.
You keep telling you're taking advice, you're taking the wrong advice.
That was the Labour leader, Robert Atkinson.
I have now called for the resignation of the leader of the council and of the cabinet.
It was also given a rebuke by the Prime Minister's office. One resignation has been received today from the Grenfell Tower management boss.
Meanwhile, a man accused of pretending to be a victim of the fire has appeared in court. He's facing a charge of fraud after receiving nearly £10,000 worth of clothing, accommodation and cash. Stars from Coronation Street are among hundreds who paid tribute to one of the victims of the Manchester Arena bombing at his funeral in Stockport. Martin Hett was one of 22 people who died in the attack in May. One of his heroes, the comedian Jason Manford, says he was a star in the making.
Be it his complaint letter to Tesco's because they didn't stock custard cream spread, or the fact that he got his mum's knitting to go viral. Maybe it was when he won Come Dine With Me, or got that now infamous tattoo made even bigger on Tattoo Fixers.
Charlie Gard's parents have been given more time before his life support is switched off. Chris Gard and Connie Yates lost a long-running legal battle for 10-month-old Charlie to be taken to the US for treatment. He suffers a rare genetic condition and has brain damage. French far-right leader Marine Le Pen's being formally investigated for an alleged breach of trust. She's accused of using EU funds to pay an assistant who wasn't based there. And Game of Thrones actor Sean Bean's married his girlfriend. The 58-year-old tied the knot with Ashley Moore yesterday in Dorset. That's the latest. I'm Charlie Max.
It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping us review this week's news is Labour councillor for Eastern, Afzal Shah. After the 6 o'clock news, an intelligence report made public for the first time this year reveals evidence the Nazis may well have successfully tested an atom bomb roughly 9 months before the Manhattan Project's Trinity test on the 16th of July 1945. Two Luftwaffe staff and a delegate from Italy described seeing Hitler's mushroom cloud near the North German city of Lübeck early in October 1944. In his book Critical Mass, US writer Carter Heydrich looks at a shipment of Nazi-enriched uranium needed to build the new atom bomb, which was shipped off at the end of the war to Japan, but eventually ended up in the hands of the Americans. So, was Nazi uranium needed to build the atom bomb? Actually used to attack Hiroshima, that is, uranium bomb Fat Man, and Nagasaki, which ended the war in the Pacific. Also, hate preacher Tommy Robinson, another British-based Jewish group, Jewish Voice, this week condemned him for inflaming hatred against Muslims. In the same way, Hitler scapegoated the Jews. But how come the police protect his freedom of speech? And what about the far-right factories that foster this racial hatred? That is the fascist and far-right incubator groups and individuals. Their purpose to incite racial hatred and make money for private military companies, mercenaries and reconstruction firms abroad. Former US Naval Intelligence Agent Kenyon Gibson infiltrated them in London and names names tonight. Who are the key players in the groups they set up, both in the UK and the US? Plus, Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots, all in the second hour after six. On to our news in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 14 Celsius and mainly dry. This weekend, highs of 21, mainly cloudy, with some lengthy spells of sunshine. Next week, highs of 21 Celsius, plenty of sunny spells and showers. The next weekend, the 8th and 9th of July, highs of 21 and sunny spells. Certainly looks like we're going to see a bit more sun than we saw this week, which was virtually zero. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news is Labour councillor for East and Afzal, Shahai. Afzal, welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, Tony. Thank you so much for inviting me on.
A pleasure to have you. Now, tell us about what you might make of this Grenfell Tower fire in London, because I think many people are still looking at this, absolutely amazed, almost seeing it as a provocation to riot, because the warning signs were well there beforehand.
Well, firstly, if I can just begin by echoing what London Mayor Sadiq Khan has said, it's just absolute astonishment that Nick Paget-Brown, the leader of Chelsea and Kensington Borough Council, has actually decided to have this meeting regarding the Grenfell Tower tragedy, the fire which actually took place there in secrecy behind closed doors, away from the media as well and the public. Unbelievable. And I will actually also ask for him to actually resign. Just unbelievable. Who are you representing? You're actually representing the local residents, your constituency. How dare he have a meeting without taking them into conference?
What about here in Bristol? Because there's actually an increasing number of meetings take place in secret associated with the City Council, not necessarily the City Council itself. They can call closed sessions at the Council, but there are quite a lot of other groups which do meet behind closed doors. That is to say, the things like the Local Enterprise Partnership can do that. Often the minutes aren't very easy to get hold of. They only get published a long time after. It seems to be a slow migration away from open government with local authorities and central government, a way to a kind of private business mentality. I wonder if you would agree with that.
I would, actually, because you see many individuals who actually represent vested interests. It is in their interest to have closed meetings and divvy up the resources amongst themselves. I've been very critical of the LEP, actually. I don't know a single business in my ward, in Eastern Ward, where we sat here today, that has received a penny of LEP funding. They don't know what the procedures are. However, this is also an issue about leadership, and one thing that I would say that certainly the current administration that we've got in Bristol City Council, they do like to do things far more openly. We only have to look at the Bundred report in terms of the way that officers were conducting themselves at Bristol City Council previously, and the black hole which that has left. So I will continue making sure that any meetings that I'm party to, or any of the key representatives that I work, that all meetings do actually take place openly, transparently. Why would you want a meeting to actually take place behind closed doors? Why? Who exactly are you trying to protect? What resources are you trying to hide?
Well, Martin, some people would say probably that this is for purposes of commercial confidentiality.
Well, that then brings into question the whole thing about subcontracting, which is obviously another big issue surrounding the Grenfell Tower fire. Because once you've got subcontracting going on and people submitting bids which are commercially confidential, I would argue that if public money is involved, then you shouldn't really have commercial confidentiality in these bids.
Well, those bidders will say they want their bid to be confidential.
Well, that's why, ultimately, you can't use public money to be spent by private organisations.
Now, as I understand it, with Grenfell Tower, Leadbitters actually put in a bid which was a bit more than Ryden Construction, and they were thrown out because they were too expensive.
Well, that's right. And, of course, all of this stuff used to be run in-house. That's how it used to be run. And there was a reason for that, because once you bring the private sector in, all this question of commercial confidentiality starts to arise. Now, when public money is involved, you can't really have commercial confidentiality. It's not reasonable. And the whole PFI system is based on commercial confidentiality and all the rest of it. If public money's involved, it can't be commercially confidential. And if private companies want to bid for public work, then they've got to accept that it's not going to be commercially confidential. And if they don't want the work, they don't have to have it. And that's the reason why things like fire safety and construction were always run in-house by local authorities until the 1980s.
But a lot of people are pointing out, Afzal, that Marvin is just simply implementing Westminster cuts. It almost was pointless voting him in.
it's a very difficult juncture that we're at. Let us be abundantly clear. These cuts are imposed by central government. Let us be abundantly clear. I mean, one thing that I can say is that Marvin has been trying to build those links. So Sajid Javid, who actually grew up in Easton, his family had a business on Stapleton Road. He's the community secretary. Marvin has had a number of meetings with him, tried to build up that working relationship with him. We can see that Theresa May came to Bristol the other day. Marvin didn't know. I don't know what the intention was of Theresa May to actually snub the directly elected mayor of Bristol, who actually represents the best part of 500,000 people.
Well,
locally.
As I understand it, she also snubbed the Metro mayor, who was a Conservative. I'm not sure if you know about that, but that's
yes.
What I've read, that she didn't even visit him.
Well, she was here visiting Orchard School in Hawfield, formerly Monk's Park School. You would think that the cabinet member for the education remit, Claire Hiscott, would have been informed. She was not informed, and she's a Tory councillor.
It does sound, Martin, like we're dealing with a government that is completely separate, almost in an ivory tower. When they come to Bristol, they parachute in, they parachute out.
Yeah, and of course they're paying the price for that. That during the general election campaign, the lack of the common touch was pretty much obvious to all in relation to Theresa May. And, you know, as George Osborne so rightly says, she's a dead woman walking.
Why might she say that?
Because there's going to be further trouble further down the line. At the moment, the Tories are rallying round because they've just managed to cobble together an administration. But it's very fragile. Frankly, Theresa May lacks basic political skills. And, of course, her own side realise that, but they don't know what to do about it.
Well, they've got to have themselves a leadership election, I imagine, at some point. But anyway, one of the main planks of the new government, if you can call it a plank, it's a little bit rickety, maybe made of balsa wood, and I'm not sure quite how long it's going to last, but it's not quite the kind of wood that made the Matthew, is it? But this one here, we're going to hear now from Prime Minister's Questions on Wednesday, because the deal that's been done with the DUP was revealed this week, and so we're going to have a little listen to a question about that now, which comes from Kevin Brennan at Prime Minister's Questions on Wednesday.
Mr. Kevin Brennan!
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Regarding this deal that she's done with the DUP, is it true that on the one hand she's shelling out all this extra money to secure their support, whilst on the other hand she's still giving them taxpayers cash in the form of short money to be in opposition? Is that what we get from this Prime Minister? No pay rise for the nurses, but double bubble for her friends in the DUP.
Let's be clear about what the government has done in the agreement with the Democratic Unionist Party. As a result of this election, there was no party that had a majority in this House. Only... Yes? Only... The party that had the largest number of seats and the only party that can form an effective government is the Conservative Party. That's the right thing to do, and that's what we've done.
Well, isn't that interesting? Because, of course, if there'd been a proportional election, as they routinely have in Northern Ireland, she wouldn't have been the largest party. So it does beg the question about the electoral system there. But also, of course, the fact that the DUP are getting short money for being in opposition. In other words, they get some of the money to be the opposition, but in actual fact, they're supporting the government.
But what about the failure?
In coalition with the government, because if they were in coalition with the government, that would break the Anglo-Irish agreement.
You mean the Good Friday agreement? Well, what about this announcement this week as well that Stormont is not going to be meeting, and it looks like there's going to have to be some sort of just continuation of direct rule, which effectively means the DUP are running the show.
Well, it does, but I mean, it just brings to the fore what a rickety structure the British political system actually is, where the DUP won't be able to form a regime in Northern Ireland with Sinn Féin, but they will be propping up the government in Westminster, which will then rule Northern Ireland indirectly, with no locals having any say in it apart from the DUP, which is a way of getting round the Good Friday Agreement. I don't think there's any danger of a return to violence, but big questions are going to have to be asked. I mean, the six counties voted to remain inside the EU. That's quite clear. The DUP haven't got a mandate to take the six counties outside out of the European Union. If we're going to have referendums deciding things, that was a referendum.
Afsal, what do you make of this deal? Because this is majorly important for the Northern Irish. It means effectively that it doesn't matter which way they voted, really, the DUP is running the show over there. That the many of whom were actually loyalists originally, now it's the Unionist Party. Sinn Féin, the Nationalists, and the Republicans are completely cut out.
Well, just go show just how divisive the DUP stroke Tory coalition actually is, and also goes show just how desperate Theresa May is to actually cling on to power by hook or by crook. So on the one hand, we're telling the nurses and the firefighters that we don't have a penny for you, yet we're more than happy to shell out over £1 billion just for Theresa May to continue in power for just a few months longer.
The magic money tree obviously is there for the DUP, Martin. It's also actually there when it comes to quantitative easing, isn't it?
It is. I mean, I think what's happened is people have rumbled that in actual fact you don't have to balance the books, which is what we've been banging our head on a brick wall about for 7 years. We haven't balanced the books in 7 years, and the sky hasn't fallen in. And once you decide that we're not about balancing the books, it then becomes the question, well, what do we need? Well, we need a pay rise for nurses and police officers and fire people. And there's no saying that there isn't the money. The money's there. We can make the money up if we want to. And, of course, people have now realised that. But previously they thought that we couldn't.
Time for a correction from last week, because Martin, I'm going to have to tick you off here, I'm afraid.
Yes, okay.
You erroneously said, thanks very much for the listener that got in touch to point this out, and I did a bit of digging around, and the European Court of Justice... Yes, it's part of the European Union, and there are several countries which are not part of the European Court of Justice. So I'll just run through them now. Iceland, Norway, Switzerland, Bosnia, Montenegro, Albania, Serbia, Kosovo, Macedonia, Belarus, Ukraine, Moldova, Andorra, Monaco, Liechtenstein, San Marino and Vatican City. So none of those are actually in the European Union. That means they're not in the European Court of Justice. Also worth looking at this, because there's several tiers to all of this. There's the euro as well. So whether you're in the single market, you can be in the single market, but not in the euro. 9 out of the 28 countries opted out of the euro. That's the countries in the EU. That's Denmark, Sweden, Poland, Czech Republic, Croatia, Hungary, Romania, Bulgaria, and Britain. None of them are in the eurozone. But there is something else called the European Free Trade Area Court. What they do is they decide on trade disputes between countries who are outside the eurozone. And I'm really surprised I've heard so little about the European Free Trade Area, because obviously if we're going to be outside the single market, we can still stay in the single market if we're in the European Free Trade Area, AFSEL. Now, I hope I'm not losing everybody here, but why haven't we heard more about the European Free Trade Area, which includes Iceland, Liechtenstein, Norway and Switzerland? Because that's probably where we're going to end up.
Well, Europe is the largest trading partner of the United Kingdom. Some people seem to think it's America, but it's not. According to the facts, it is Europe.
But hang on, because Iceland, Liechtenstein, Norway and Switzerland are all in Europe too. It's just not in the EU.
They tend to be sidelined, I guess. The attention is always far too often on the key trading partners, which tends to be Germany, France and Italy, as opposed to some of the other key players as well.
One of the things that shocked me too was this week on the Electronic Intifada, the European Union pledged to help Israel suppress criticism. Now, the Electronic Intifada have written about this week because there is a new definition in European law being brought in, and the Israeli lobby has been successfully lobbying to change it, Martin, to include criticism of Israel as being anti-Semitic. Now, this does bother me, particularly with the European Court of Justice too months ago ruling that any employer can sack an employee if they're found to be wearing a hijab at work. They can effectively be sacked on the spot, and if they go to a headscarf, and if they go to a tribunal, they will lose the case according to the European Court of Justice.
Well, There's lots of litigation goes on at the European Court of Justice and at the Supreme Court in Britain. We used to have just the House of Lords. We now have a Supreme Court. I think the idea, I mean, we have incorporated into British law a definition of anti-Semitism, which includes criticism of the State of Israel, totally unacceptably to my mind. And of course, there's also been in the US, they've been passing all of these laws locally in various jurisdictions, saying that nobody's allowed to campaign for a boycott of Israeli goods and services. And of course, in the 1980s, it was the boycott of the big US cities of apartheid which brought down the South African regime. So they've tightened all these loopholes up so that you can't actually campaign in the way we used to do. All of which is unacceptable. It's not a question of whether it's a European court or a British court. It's unacceptable because it's too much power for the Zionist lobby.
In this statement, it also includes criticism of Israel and its state ideology, Zionism, including denying the Jewish people their right to self-determination by claiming the existence of the State of Israel is a racist endeavour. So if you do that, that's anti-Semitic, apparently.
Well, I'd just like to say that's completely wrong. I don't accept that for a minute. The State of Israel was recognised in 1948 on the understanding that it would remain behind the Green Line. It's never remained behind the Green Line since 1967. Therefore, it's perfectly legitimate for people to say, if you're not going to play by the rules, we're going to de-recognise you. There's no particular reason why you should have a seat at the United Nations. Kashmir hasn't got a seat at the United Nations. Crimea hasn't got a seat at the United Nations.
Yeah, so could,
Bosnia hasn't
got
a seat.
Do you mind being accused of being anti-Semitic for saying that?
If people accuse us of being anti-Semitic for saying that, I think it's a row that we're going to have, because it's a political decision. There's no particular reason why the Palestinians, for example, should recognise the State of Israel. The State of Palestine is not recognised by the Israelis, is it? Now, the quid pro quo is, we'll recognise you if you recognise us. It's a bit like the Good Friday Agreement we were talking about earlier. And the idea that criticism of the State of Israel, or even the existence of the State of Israel, is anti-Semitic, is frankly wrong. And we're going to confront that. We're not just going to accept that. The Israelis are intervening as we speak in the Syrian war. They're supporting jihadis, Al-Qaeda. They've been flying air support for Al-Qaeda, as the Western powers have also been intervening. I don't think we're going to say exactly what we think about it. And if they don't like it, that's just too bad.
Afsal, what do you make of these sort of definitions of anti-Semitism? Because obviously it's very important to make sure that racially motivated hatred, statement, speech is not necessarily prosecuted, but it certainly should be lent on. It should be discouraged in some way.
Absolutely. I've always failed to understand why the State of Israel, so we have to be abundantly clear here, the State of Israel, as opposed to the Jewish religion and the Jewish faith, should be beyond any manner of criticism whatsoever. Before the election on June the 8th, over 256 candidates, who are now MPs, signed a pledge with the Friends of Israel, say that if they're elected as parliamentarians, they will support Israel on a wide-ranging number of issues, politically, economically, socially, culturally. Some may call that being proactive, but it's just that why is it that we are not allowed to voice any concern about the practices of the State of Israel, especially in the way that they've treated the Palestinians in terms of the land that they've illegally occupied, the Golan Heights. I would also like to add that in 2014 I organised a town hall meeting where three of Bristol's four MPs were there, and the fourth MP, Dawn Primrolo, she sent a representative there. So all MPs were represented. The mayor at the time, George Ferguson, was there. Key stakeholders of the local Muslim community and academics and people as far afield as Birmingham attended. There was a very frank and fair discussion about Western foreign policy in general and what Israel was doing to the Palestinians at the time in the Gaza Strip. They were bombing them at the time. At the end of the meeting, it was agreed with the mayor of Bristol and including all four MPs that there would be a draft statement that would be hand delivered by Muslims from Bristol, key Muslim representatives, including myself, and the mayor at the time, George Ferguson, would be hand delivered to number 10 Downing Street. However, not only were any details of that meeting stopped from going to the Bristol Post, we were told that the details of the meeting would actually be disseminated there. Three key representatives from lobbying groups actually travelled down to Bristol from London. They told the mayor at the time, in no uncertain terms, "Sorry, mate, this statement ain't going nowhere." That was the end of it. I found out from one of the MPs at the time what had happened, because I was getting people in the Muslim community saying, "Look, where's this statement? You guys were actually going to take this to 10 Downing Street, deliver it to the Prime Minister at the time, David Cameron, asking for Britain to actually use its political leverage against Israel to actually stop the bombings and look at improving humanitarian affairs." It was stopped dead in its tracks. Why is it that Israel seems to have so much clout? And I'm talking about the state of Israel.
Martin, we had at the same time, didn't we, the BBC actually suppressed a Disasters Emergency Committee appeal that was they wanted to get out on the BBC. The BBC said, "No, you're not allowed to do that."
Well, I think the fundamental... Let's get to the fundamental point about this. Zionism is a political movement. And Zionism, there's no particular reason why people should support Zionism, whether they're Jewish or not. Plenty of Jewish people are not Zionists around the world, including many Orthodox Jews. They actually find Zionism offensive from a religious point of view, if, apart from anything else. And there's absolutely no reason why anybody should have to accept the Zionist narrative about the state of Israel. The state of Israel was only recognised, as I said, in 1948 on various conditions. It's basically broken all of those conditions, and therefore it's absolutely legitimate for the world community to discuss whether Israel should have a seat at the United Nations at all. There are plenty of communities around the world who would like to have a seat at the United Nations. I mentioned some of them earlier, but they don't. You don't get them because we don't just recognise people. There's a whole sort of set of hoops you have to jump through, and then if you don't do as you're told, then they can be withdrawn. It's a privilege to be a member of the United Nations and be recognised as a country. And I think Israel, for example, has got 200 plus nuclear weapons in complete defiance of international law. Now, at some point, you might say, "Well, you can have your nuclear weapons, but you can't have your seat at the United Nations. We're not going to recognise your state." And that's a non-violent way to send a very clear message. You're not going to be a state if you carry on like this, and the Israelis have got to understand that. The state can be dismantled in the sense that it's not going to be recognised by anybody else. And they can say, "But you've got to recognise you." They say, "No, we don't. We don't have to recognise you. Behave yourself, otherwise we will stop recognising you."
OK, well, we're going to go back to the Grenfell Tower story now. And there's a pretty shocking exchange yesterday at Kensington Chelsea Town Hall with the first cabinet meeting, which was due to be convened after the tragic fire. And this is what transpired, because Nick Paget-Brown, the leader of the council, Conservative leader of the council, said that because there were public and press around in the meeting, that he was advised by, I imagine, the head of legal services for the council, that the meeting couldn't take place, which is pretty horrific in a democracy. Anyway, let's listen to a little transcript of that now, or a recording of that now, and you can hear as part of that the voices of Nick Paget-Brown, and also intervening the Labour leader of Kensington and Chelsea Council, Robert Atkinson.
"We can't have an unprejudiced discussion in this room with the public inquiry that's about to take place if journalists are recording and writing our comments."
"Clearly they are. Who let them in? You've spent a day talking about the security of this meeting, and then 5 minutes before it starts, now you're telling us we can't have a proper meeting?"
"I'm told the press are here because of the result of legal intervention, and that therefore means that we cannot have a discussion as we were intending to have, because that will prejudice the public inquiry. That is the legal advice I've received, and I therefore have to declare the meeting closed."
"So what you've done is you've actually used this as an opportunity for you to make a statement, and nobody else gets to say anything at all. You could have issued that statement, in fact you should have issued that statement, 8 days ago."
"I would like to have had a conversation, but I'm advised that we can't do that because we were prejudiced."
"An absolute yes. This is why I am calling for your resignation.
So, yes, that was Robert Atkinson, Labour leader of the council, replying to Nick Paget Brown. And there's been developments, and we're joined on the line by Robert Atkinson now from London. Robert, what's happened?
Hello. I gather that Nick Paget Brown has finally resigned.
Can you just give us from your point of view? I mean, obviously, you've been meeting with residents. In fact, I believe your ward is actually the area of Grenfell Tower. What your impression is now about what has happened so far and what's going to happen in the future?
Well, I'm glad that Nick Paget Brown and the leader of the Tenants Managers Organisation have both gone today, because that helps to clear a way for someone else to get a grip of this council, so that my residents, my grieving residents, my homeless residents, can now be taken care of in a proper and orderly manner. So nothing is going to bring back the up to 100 residents of my ward, but at least once we get some decent leadership from the council, we can make sure that those who have been left behind and those who are grieving can get some decent services and be looked after. That's the least we can do.
Now, you've called them incompetent, you called for them to resign, they've done that. Why have you said that they are incompetent? Because it does seem as if that there are lots and lots of lines from this fire lead back to decisions made at Kensington and Chelsea Council.
Yes, I am not speculating as to how the fire happened in the first place. The reason for my anger is that it's simply the way in which they failed to respond once the fire had taken place. Everybody else rose to the challenge. The council completely collapsed.
How would you describe the way they've acted then? Because you're an insider, you've seen what's been going on. It's almost as if we haven't seen very much of Paget Brown, apart from on Newsnight, where he got actually a fairly easy ride from the Newsnight people.
He disappeared for a week and then came back, and last night tried to pretend that they were back in control and tried to pretend that they had some role in some of the good things that have been taking place in the last week. But actually, good things have happened despite the leadership of Kensington and Chelsea Council, not because of them.
Many people have pointed to the sort of creeping privatisation, arm's length management of these sorts of... We don't really have that very much here in Bristol. In fact, we decided not to have the TMOs. What do you make of the way that the refurbishment and the care for these council properties was managed?
Kensington used to be an old-fashioned patrician council who took responsibility for things like housing, and they did things themselves. It wasn't perfect, but at least you had some leadership and you knew who to go to when there was a problem. This whole experiment of privatisation and of seeking to have outside bodies take over the responsibility of the council has been a complete fiasco, and that is why, once there was a tragedy of the size of Grenfell Tower, the council no longer had the people in place to respond to it. They deliberately ran down council services. They went in for this ridiculous tri-borough arrangement, which meant that come the crisis, there wasn't people in place.
Now, you've seen this at first hand. What message have you got for other councils around the country, not least of which is our Bristol council here, about the way they manage their housing?
I think it is very important that we now have a national debate about the proper provision of social housing, both for social cohesion and to make sure that the people of this country are all entitled to a decent place to live. We have ignored the housing needs of large numbers of our population, particularly in London, but in other cities as well, including Bristol. We need to build social housing. It's not complicated. There are not enough houses for ordinary people being built, and I'm calling upon the government to make sure that we now have a proper house building programme and we go back to a system of proper social housing provision.
Some have also said there's been a kind of cleansing going on there, or not necessarily ethnic cleansing, but social cleansing.
Yes. Kensington has been exporting its poor people for at least a decade.
Horrific. And do you think that now that will stop with this wake-up call?
It's a terrible price to pay, and I wouldn't want Grenfell Tower to be described as a wake-up call, but it is a symbol of what has gone wrong with housing. And the whole denigration of local government. But local government has always been important, and the attitude of national government has been that local government was not important. They did not give people the money. They carried on piling responsibilities. They encouraged councils to withdraw from direct provision of services, and this is where we've ended up.
Some are also saying that there is a sort of almost like a symbol of this recent general election here, the ideologies between Conservative and Labour. Do you think that's any truth in that?
Yes, I think the era of austerity is over, but I don't want to go into that tonight. I'm still trying to sort out things for my residents.
OK, Robert Atkinson, Labour leader of Kensington Chelsea Council, thanks very much for joining us on The Politics Show.
Bye-bye.
Now, Martin, it's quite interesting to hear. He really is quite clearly saying that housing policy and privatisation has got a lot to do with what happened.
Well, I think that's pretty obvious, isn't it? As you say, in Bristol, we've had a lucky escape because we didn't get any of these TMOs, and we've still got social housing or council housing is still managed as it used to be. But I'm sure we need to think about whether we can improve that. I'm sure there will be room for improvement.
Also hearing that this today, that the cladding approved by residents was then quietly by Kensington and Chelsea Council and the contractors Ryden swapped for cheaper cladding, and they managed to save £300,000 on that refurbishment, Afzal.
I think there's a lot of lessons to be learned. Firstly, if I can begin just by saying that I welcome the news shared by Councillor Atkinson that Robert Paget Brown has finally decided to resign. Sadly, it's taken the loss of about 100 lives. I think a lot of lessons must be learnt from this. We are fortunate that in Bristol that we don't have that. I have been in contact with Councillor Paul Smith, who's got the housing remit, make sure that there is a review conducted. He has been busy visiting most of the 59 high-rise flats that we've got in Bristol to actually ensure that nothing of that nature could actually take place here owing to the cladding safety issues. I think that we really need to have a wider debate around social housing. We have to simply start building more homes. We need the resources from central government. But also, if you look at the chocolate factory development, which is just up the road, the developers can actually hide behind the viability report, which actually, when it came to councillors, was actually initially redacted. So, going back to the issue about secrecy, seemed like there is a culture.
Well, nationally. Because that's absolutely appalling. You're being asked to make a decision and contribute to a decision about whether a development can go ahead, and you're actually been even as a councillor being allowed to see. What I mean, how on earth can that be excused? It just sounds to me like there's a culture of secrecy here, and when people are up to no good, possibly even in this case. With corporate manslaughter charges may come, that they want to cover up the contract, parts of the contract that they don't want you to see.
Sadly, that is the battle that local authorities are currently fighting. This is legislation that was brought in by the previous Tory administration under David Cameron, and it must be repealed. And we've certainly had these conversations with the Labour Party nationally to ensure that not if, but when we come to power, hopefully it'll be within months, that is one of the first pieces of legislation that we'd like to actually remove with immediate effect.
Well, it's literally only about 10 minutes ago that Nick Paget-Brown resigned, so you heard it here first, folks, straight from the horse's mouth, straight from Kensington, Chelsea's Labour leader there. But this whole subject did come up at Prime Minister's Questions, of course, with Theresa May and Jeremy Corbyn. I don't know how many there's going to be, actually, because there's going to be a few before they break for the summer. The whole thing seems a little bit farcical, really, in a democracy, and they're just going to have a few of these questions, and then off they go with a very, very fragile majority. So anyway, let's have a listen now to Wednesday's PMQs.
Why is it that fire inspections, that local authority inspections, appear to have missed this essential issue?
I think I can help the Prime Minister with this issue. When you cut local authority expenditure by 40%, you end up with fewer building control inspectors. Mr. Speaker, I was simply making the point, which seems to have upset a lot of members opposite, that when you cut local authority budgets by 40%, we all pay a price in public safety. fewer inspectors, fewer building control inspectors, fewer planning inspectors, we all pay a price. Mr. Speaker, those cuts to the fire service have meant there are 11,000 fewer firefighters. The public sector pay cap is hitting recruitment and retention right across the public sector. What the tragedy of Grenfell Tower has exposed is the disastrous effects of austerity. Disregard for working class communities, the terrible consequences of deregulation and cutting corners. I urge the Prime Minister to come up with the resources needed to test and remove cladding, retrofit sprinklers, properly fund the fire service and the police, so that all our communities can truly feel safe in their own homes. Mr. Speaker, this disaster must be a wake-up call.
The cladding of tower blocks did not start under this government. It did not start under the previous coalition government. The cladding of tower blocks began under the Blair government. The Right Honourable Gentleman talks about local authority resources and talks about changes to the regulation. In 2005, it was a Labour government that introduced the Regulatory Reform Fire Safety Order, which changed the requirement to inspect a building on fire safety from the local fire authority, which was usually the fire brigade, to a responsible person. The legislation governing fire safety in tower blocks was, and this was commented on by the Lackenall House report into that fire. It criticised that 2005 order, which had been put in place by the Labour government.
Order. The Prime Minister's answer must be heard, and it will be. Prime Minister.
And laws which took effect in 2006 ended the practice of routine fire service inspections, passing the responsibility to councils. That is why I say to the Right Honourable Gentleman, this should be an issue that across this House we recognise is a matter that has been developing over decades, is a matter that has occurred under governments of both colours, under councils of all political persuasions, and is something which I would hope we would say we should come together and ensure that we get to the answers of why this has happened over many years, what has gone wrong, and how do we stop it from happening in the future.
That was the Prime Minister replying there to Jeremy Corbyn. But his point, Afzal, really was about cuts to local government. Now, this is carrying on. It's carrying on. In probably about 5-6 years' time, we could be in a situation where there's virtually no funding coming to Bristol from central government. It's like they're sort of cutting off the money bit by bit. They're saying to Bristol City Council, well, you can carry on, but you're going to have to raise money yourself.
40%. Of cuts, just as Jeremy Corbyn was alluding to local authorities. You can see the tough decisions that we're having to make locally in terms of having to potentially close down all of our public toilets. And now we're faced by that daunting prospect because of central government policy. And I think it's very important that all the core cities, which incidentally are Labour local authorities, to actually sit down and I think that we must unite on this issue.
So why aren't we doing that already? I mean, Marvin's been here for over a year now.
Well, Marvin is having those conversations behind the scenes. There is a lot of work actually taking place.
What, in secret meetings?
No, definitely not secret meetings. No, no.
we need to hear it, don't we, on a national level, really. I mean, there's no point in having conversations a year on from being elected. It's still something needs to happen. And certainly those conversations should be happening on a national level and in public.
Now, we appreciate that, you know, a week is not a long time in politics. Well, definitely, a year is definitely not a long time in politics either. I think that in terms of home building, In terms of the work that we're doing in terms of community cohesion with local schools and everything, public health work, there is quite a lot that has been achieved locally, as Marvin was speaking about the annual statement which he made at full council earlier this week. However, I think we need to continue putting pressure on central government, but some people have said, look, why not just set an illegal budget? But then you literally get a Section 151 officer who will actually step in and say, no, sorry, guys, you can't do that. And then we go back to the days such as those in the 80s where we get central government saying, look, we cannot trust local authorities set their own budget. It just feeds into the narrative of central government. And I think it's very important that we just remember that is central government that is responsible for these cuts. Everything that we see here locally and nationally, it is because of austerity. How much more can it continue? I mean, for example, now Bristol's part of a pilot project where we have retention of 100% business rates, because obviously they want to scrap the grant which we get from central government, and now putting that pressure back locally onto small businesses. So I think it's very important as a local authority that we must do everything that we can within the resources that we have to actually support local businesses, especially small businesses.
Martin, we're also seeing, I mean, just actually maybe staying with you, Afzal, this week, the campaign to save Jubilee Pool in Knowle. It seems that the things like these council services are only saved if there are a group of city councillors and activists, local residents, who fight tooth and nail to keep them. At the end of the day, the council doesn't want to do it. It's the path of least resistance. If it can close any service without getting too much of a hard time, it will do.
This is not just something that, you know, these tough decisions that we're currently having to make are not something that is just a decision being faced by this authority. They're being faced by authorities up and down the country. Talking about pools, if you look at Speedwell Swim Pool, which I used to actually go to as a child myself, that was closed down by the Lib Dems. That was a decision that they made. That was a hugely popular pool, but they felt that...
It's still there, isn't it? I suppose it's got some allotments and stuff around it, I think, isn't it? Am I right?
That's right, yes, yeah. But it just goes to show that that building has been there for well over a decade. Nothing's happened. So I think it's somewhat disingenuous of people from other political persuasions to be saying, well, the Labour Party administration in Bristol has only kept this open because of opposition. Yes, opposition, grassroots opposition, or rather grassroots activism, I would call it, is fundamental. But it does unfortunately go back to, we've got very limited resources. Where should that money be spent? And I think the good thing is that we've got consultation going on at the moment. What I would request is that everybody, local residents, all stakeholders, get involved. Make sure that you do become part of that consultation. Go on Bristol City Council website. It's got the links on there. You can actually have a look at the tough decisions which we're being faced by, but also what the implications are of each and every cut.
Martin, I mean, you've argued, haven't you, for Sinn Féin over in Northern Ireland. They say, well, look, it's actually better for people to say, well, let's let direct rule from Westminster do these cuts, because all it does is discredits people who have been trying to vote against those cuts by voting Labour. They feel that Labour are just simply implementing what the Tories are telling them to.
Yeah, but you've got to remember it's a rather different circumstance. Sinn Féin do not want to be part of the British state at all. So, in other words, them participating in the power-sharing executive...
A lot of people vote for them, don't they?
They do vote for them, and the sticking point, actually, because the DUP have managed to get more money out of the central government, so, in other words, austerity is over in Northern Ireland, so that one's kind of died. The sticking point is actually about Irish language rights at the minute. But, of course, the Labour Party didn't knock on doors when Marvin was elected saying we're going to do an illegal budget. And if we had, we wouldn't necessarily have won. because ordinary folk don't like the cuts, but they also realise that setting an illegal budget, it's a tactic. But if you pursue that tactic, it's all or nothing, and most people aren't prepared for all or nothing. In Northern Ireland, they are prepared for all or nothing. The people on the nationalist side who voted for Sinn Féin is because they want a united Ireland. They've always wanted a united Ireland. They don't actually want to negotiate with the British government about anything at all. Really.
Okay, on to another story. Now, the National Audit Office, this was tail ended last week. Actually, missed this one. Slams the government's high cost and risky deal for Hinkley Point nuclear power station. You may remember tail end of last year we spoke to Paul Mobbs on this programme in the second hour, discovering to our amazement that for about a third of the price of Hinkley Point you could have the same amount of energy roughly generated through tidal energy in the Severn, because the Severn is one of the two greatest areas of tidal reach, that is to say amount of water going in and out every day, twice a day in fact. So anyway, the government's decision to commission a new nuclear power station at Hinkley Point, which will receive an estimated subsidy of £30 billion, has been condemned as a high risk and high cost and risky deal by the head of the National Audit Office. The head of the NAO said ministers had failed to look at alternative ways of funding the power station to get the best deal possible, saying officials expect it will add up to £15 to all electricity bills right across the country up until 2030. The renewable energy industry accused the government of ignoring the most cost-effective forms of electricity generation, that is onshore wind and solar, and as I mentioned there, tidal, which is only just coming on stream now. The Queen is investing in tidal energy. She thinks it's a good idea. Why doesn't government?
It once again goes back to vested interest. There's a lot of pressure from the Chinese. We know that China is now the second biggest economy globally, with a GDP of $12 trillion, just behind the Americans. And Britain, obviously, under this Tory administration, wants to cozy up to the Chinese. I think if we look at what they're doing in Germany and many other places, many Scandinavian countries, they're investing in solar, in tidal, so many other means of renewable energy, and it's such a shame, not only for us but for our children and our grandchildren, that this is a lost opportunity.
Martin, a lot of money goes into this stuff, doesn't it? Construction of Hinkley C, which is being built in Somerset by French power firm EDF and the China General Nuclear Power Group, has just begun, amid concerns about whether the type of reactor to be installed will actually work. Now, chatting to people that know about such things, they say that the money will only be there for this deal if this Flamanville reactor in France is successful for 6 months up to round about this time of year now, but it hasn't even started operating yet, so it doesn't look as if the money is going to be able to come through, although the Europeans would allow this money to arrive to build this power station. Also, there's been cracks appearing in the reactor pressure vessels for the Flamanville reactor. The other thing is, of course, it's the same type of reactor that was behind Chernobyl and Three Mile Island, so do we really want this thing? Is it just a complete lame duck?
Well, in actual fact, I think the Austrian government, because we're still part of the EU and Austria is part of the EU, were actually trying to argue that it was it was basically state support of industry, because what you've got with EDF and the Chinese is essentially the Chinese and French state, and massive subsidy from the British state or by the British taxpayer. And it's basically breaks EU competition regulations. And of course, as Afzal says, it's really vested interest. It's like once you've said you're going to do it, and all these people have lined their ducks up, and they can imagine that they're desperate but both the Chinese and the French are desperate to sell nuclear power because they've committed to it, and it doesn't make any money in France or in China, so they've got to sell more on. It's a bit like being a heroin addict. You've got to sell more heroin to other people if you're going to pay for your own habit. But of course, it doesn't make any economic sense, and it never has.
Also, what with the recent spate of terror attacks, over three, I think, in 3 months, the beginning, first 3 months of the year, up to April, and plus, just in the run-up to the general election as well, one would have thought that the money that the central government is spending on counter-terrorism would have gone up, but not, according to Ian Austin at Prime Minister's Questions on Wednesday.
Ian Austin!
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Will the Prime Minister confirm that last week
Britain's four most senior police officers, the Commissioner of the Met, the heads of counter-terrorism, the National Crime Agency and the Police Chiefs Council, all wrote to the government saying the counter-terrorism, policing and protective security grant is being cut by 7.2%. And doesn't this show, contrary to what she just told my honourable friend the member for Wrexham, that her promise to protect police budgets is not being kept?
No, as I've said earlier, we have protected counter-terrorism policing. We've put money in. We've also put money into an uplift in armed policing, and the Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police has made the point that the Metropolitan Police are well resourced and have a wide diversity of tools that they can use in countering terrorism. And that's the point. It's not just about the funding, it's about ensuring they have the powers they need to deal with the terrorists, and that's what we're determined to ensure.
Now, Theresa May, the Prime Minister there, Martin, is saying, well, actually what we're doing is we're increasing the number of armed police, and I wonder if you think that that is effective measures of counter-terrorism.
Well, she cut the numbers of armed police before she started to increase them again. The main point I make, the police don't need extra powers. This is a complete...
No, they're talking about money here, not
powers. Yes, exactly. They need resources. And I would say that the resources should be channeled through the police as well, because I don't trust the intelligence services to handle the money effectively.
And what happens, with a budget like this cut by 7.2%, protests from all the police, etc. involved. The Prime Minister at the moment, even though she's on a bit of a sticky wicket when it comes to her majority, just ignores it.
Well, because they can't make up their mind whether they're going to accept that the austerity era is over or not. And, of course, you've got right-wingers like Sajid Javid in there who are saying that we've got to carry on cutting to the bone. And, of course, you know, there's more moderate Tories who are saying, we can't keep doing that.
And also Martin.
But they have not necessarily got the whip out.
Martin, I mean, Theresa May would argue we've got more armed police, that costs money, so that budget's gone up, and also more money for MI5.
Well, I'm not very happy for more money for the intelligence services, because I don't think they spend it. You know, it's not accountable. But the fact is that Theresa May herself cut fire officers, police officers, and armed police officers when she was Home Secretary. So even if she increases the money she spends on it now, and in fact they're not, we're way behind the curve on this.
Afsal, what do you make of that 7.2% cut?
Unbelievable, especially considering what's happened nationally. I'm also on the police and crime panel for even Somerset Constabulary. I have voiced my concerns about the fact that in the past decade we've lost over 800 officers in the Constabulary. Many of those cutbacks have been seen and witnessed on the streets of Bristol. I know so many people who've had their homes burgled, and they've told me that the police have not been able to come immediately, even when they called 999. It is an issue about resources, but it's very important that we bear in mind the first responsibility of any state is the safety of its citizens. And I've also got concerns about the prevent budget, which is £379 million per year. Where is that money going? I don't know any grassroots organisations, groups in Bristol that have received a penny of it.
Also,
where is this money going?
Also, finally, a Muslim was knocked unconscious by thugs who then vandalised his home with racist graffiti quoting Katie Hopkins' Final Solution tweet. The victim woke from the attack to find racist graffiti daubed on his walls, which included "We need a final solution," a phrase controversially tweeted by Katie Hopkins. Martin, I mean, just very, very quickly, the news is coming up. What do you make of that?
Well, Katie Hopkins is a hate preacher, isn't she?
Okay, time for the Murdoch News at 6. Thanks to our guest, Labour Councillor for Eastern, Afsal Shaft. The Murdoch News: an intelligence report made public for the first time this year reveals evidence the Nazis may well have successfully tested an atom bomb before the Trinity Project and the Americans.
We're still bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.